doing something.
Are we on?
Well, welcome everybody to the first meeting in 2016 of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it is February 1st, 2016. Alrighty, members, we've got we have 14 bills currently in our possession. The chair's intent is that we will hear all 14 of them, and then we'll decide what we're going to do with them. Don't know, haven't had much of a chance to look through a number of them, so we'll hear it. As I told the Senate President, he says, "What are you going to do with these?" I says, "Well, we're going to hear them first, and then we'll decide what we're going to do with them." That's what we'll do. Just for the record, one of the bills we have, Senate Bill 1509, it's relating to the public purpose charge on utilities. The sponsors of that bill have asked that that bill not be heard. Their coalition apparently is disintegrated, and they decided that best wait until 2017 and work on it through the interim. So we will honor that request.
That was my only yes vote.
That was your... Well, I'm sorry, Senator. That was one you were going to support. Okay. All right. So we have four bills up today, but first we have to do a little organizational work, and we'll start out with the committee rules. I don't believe they've changed at all, have they?
No, Mr. Chair, these same are the ones, same rules that all the committees will be
same
using.
Same ones we always have to have. So the chair would move adoption of the committee rules as presented. Are there any discussions on that?
Do I have veto
Senator
power?
Rudd? Huh?
Do I have veto power?
I don't believe that's included in there, but you do have a vote. Are there any, no discussion? Is there any opposition to that? There is none. The rules are adopted unanimously. Now we'll move on to the order today. Then we're going to start out with Senate Bill 1589, followed by 1583, and then the two insurance bills, 1591 and 1590. And I should say this is not a, quote, public hearing, but it is an informational session, and we would invite anybody who wishes to comment or share their thoughts on any of the bills as we get to them to, you're welcome to do that.
Which one did you cancel?
1509.
Mm-hmm.
1509?
1509.
Mr. Chair, maybe make clear that was scheduled for Wednesday.
And that was not today. It was scheduled for Wednesday. All righty. Patrick, you want to take us off on this?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'll make some quick remarks. Senate Bill 1589 modifies the definition of qualified business eligible for loans or credit guarantees from the Credit Enhancement Fund to include existing or proposed businesses located in Oregon that will produce substantial benefits for the state. The measure has an emergency clause, so it would take effect upon passage. It also, at this point, has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
And welcome, Senators, whoever wants to go first.
Well, I'll kick it off. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Girard, and members of the committee. For the record, I am Senator Diane Rosenbaum from District 21, which is in Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. I'm very pleased to be able to start your hearing today by bringing you, together with my other chief sponsors, Senate Bill 1589, which is a great bill that deals with providing additional capacity for small business loans through the Credit Enhancement Fund. And the committee administrator explained what this is, but I'll just give you a little background. So the Credit Enhancement Fund is a small business loan program that has existed in Oregon for about 25 years and basically provides access to capital by guaranteeing loans for businesses that would get these loans generally through community banks and credit unions. And today you'll just be hearing from us as the chief sponsors, and then on Wednesday I think you'll take additional testimony from some of the beneficiaries and lending institutions. So this loan program has provided a great deal of help through the years. In fact, it's provided approximately 548 loans, the total about $330 million. And most of these loans have gone to businesses that have 15 or fewer employees, many of them, the majority, in rural parts of the state. And during that time, about 4,300 plus jobs have been created or retained because of the lending capacity. So what this bill would do is basically change the criteria, reinstate criteria that we were using for qualifying for the help under this bill. That expired at the end of 2015 and would basically make about $30 million in additional capital available for businesses that are trying to take advantage of this program but don't meet the current criteria. So the current criteria have included that you need to be in what's defined as a distressed community. And the good news about our economy is that as the economy's been slowly recovering, a lot of counties no longer qualify as distressed communities because they have fallen below the threshold for unemployment rate and other criteria. And there's a long list of counties that don't currently qualify. They're in my testimony, but I think maybe all of your districts include some of these counties because it includes Clackamas, Deschutes, Hood River, Morrow, Multnomah, Benton, Tillamook, Wasco, Washington, and Yamhill. And then soon slated to fall off the list are also Clatsop, Columbia, Jackson Lane, Lincoln, Marion, Polk, and Union and Wheeler counties. So essentially, by restoring and expanding the ability to use this program, we will allow a lot of small businesses in those counties that I've listed to qualify. And a few examples of the kind of applications that are currently ineligible would be a seafood retailer in Florence, private school in Hood River, a firm that does wholesale and retail sales in the Dalles, a dental practice in Heppner, and there are many other examples. So I'm sure my co-chief sponsors would like to tell you a little more about why they're supporting the bill. I will just say that we have had a lot of technical support from Business Oregon. That's the state agency that administers this program. Their legislative coordinator, John Saris, is here in the room today. If you have any technical questions, he'll be back on Wednesday with some of the lenders that have participated in this. And in closing, I would just say that it's a great bill that will enable us to do something for small business, particularly in our rural areas. And it hopefully is a bill that you can move quickly. I see that it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I'm hopeful that maybe we don't need that because it doesn't actually have a fiscal. That capacity that I talked about of an additional $30 million is the capacity of the fund right now. It's just that the criteria don't allow a lot of businesses to qualify. So thank you very much for your opportunity to hear this bill first, and we'll look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Sandra.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent the East Multnomah County, Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview. And this is an important bill for my district, and it's an important bill for small businesses in depressed areas of the state. And I do have a couple of areas that are considered depressed in East Multnomah County. And I think that Senator Rosenbaum really described it very well. I just would hope that I would encourage you to consider this bill very seriously and hope that you move it out. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. For the record, Arne Roblin, Senate District 5. Sorry, I have a cold, so hopefully you can hear and I don't lose my voice. Senate District 5, which goes from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and into parts of Sheridan, all of Sheridan and Fall City in the Valley. I think all of us know that it is the small business person that is the backbone of the economy in our state, but in particular, that's who is the economy in most of our rural communities. As you noted, there are a number of counties that are coming off the list of that would make people ineligible, Lane County being one of those. But Lane County is a large county, and part of it is over on the coast in Florence. I would say they don't think of themselves necessarily as having come out when Lane County might itself feel that way. And so Having the opportunity for our local banks and our, you know, and our local credit unions to actually have the backing of the state in order to make some loans to people who are trying to grow their business. Because if you look at the other criteria, it's growing your business, it's retaining workers, it's doing all the things that we are fighting for on the coast and around Oregon to maintain. And having the ability to do that more generally rather than just in traded sector jobs that you have to make an argument for, making it clear for the institutions that are loaning that money that they don't have to go back and check the background of the state, check background of the company, all that kind of stuff before they can actually get the loan when, in fact, they have already made an assessment that this person is doing the kinds of things that's going to make that company more productive, makes a lot of sense. And so we had the opportunity because of the fact that we had lost some of the criteria and we needed to reinstate them to look at it more wholly. And I look forward to having the opportunity to say to some of my local communities who thought otherwise that they wouldn't be qualifying and to have the backing of the state to say that they would. So I encourage you to pass this bill and to ask all the questions you need from the experts when they come back here on Wednesday.
Question, Senator Gerard?
Yeah, my understanding is this was set up to help poor counties or poor areas. Multnomah County, I'm sorry, compared to where I represent, like in Linn County, I mean, you guys are thriving. So to me, it's like taking money from us to go up to Multnomah County. So please explain why this pot of money all of a sudden should be earmarked for Multnomah County and for Eugene.
I would, this is Lori Montes-Anderson. My district is in Multnomah County, and if you look at Rockwood and Gresham, it is a distressed area. So I am hoping that these funds will make it easier for our small businesses in my part of the state to be able to access the funds.
And Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Gerard, just to clarify, we're not expanding it so that those bigger counties can qualify. If you look at my testimony, the list of counties that are currently disqualified include a lot of our smaller rural counties like Wasco, Sherman, Big River, Clackamas, and soon to include Clatsop, Columbia, Marion, Polk, Union and Wheeler counties. So if we don't restore the criteria that we had before, we're going to have a program that won't benefit most of the state that really needs to take advantage of it. And that is why we've got, I think you can hear this from Business Oregon, but we've got at least 10 different loan applications pending right now that couldn't be even considered because of just this technical requirement.
The loans that were given that I've seen from Business Oregon, I can honestly say do not go out into rural Oregon hardly at all, and they seem to be clustered in the Portland area, and it is extremely frustrating. My district, the city of Mill City, the average worker up there makes 60% of the wage earner in Portland, 60%. So, you know, for some of us representing rural areas, it's pretty tough to swallow that Multnomah County is included in your bill.
Are you done? Anything else? Go ahead, Senator.
Well, I represent portions of Multnomah County, much of the David Douglas School District, which is the second poorest district in the state in terms of assessed value per pupil. One of the problems is that not all counties have the same disparity of wealth throughout the county. Multnomah County has some high poverty areas that really need more small business, stronger jobs. Same with Clackamas County. There are portions that are really quite poor. On the other hand, downtown Portland has a lot of wealth, but I don't represent downtown Portland, not any of it. And so the portions of Multnomah County and Clackamas County that I represent are really quite poor. The school districts are poor. They need more business. They need stronger small businesses because that's where jobs are made. I think that's probably true all over the state.
And my only question maybe the experts are be better on this. I don't know who's running this program, because it says it changes the language to, this will allow any new or existing business to be eligible as long as their operations produce substantial benefit to the state. So who, do I get to make that choice? Who gets to make that choice?
Business-oriented.
And it depends on what they, that committee or that person or that agency thinks is beneficial to Oregon. So that's kind of broad. I mean, this, you can tell that this particular bill or the way this program has worked in the past, it was for very specific things, because there were probably problems at that time to enhance certain businesses with and bring jobs to certain areas. And it looks like we're just making it to, like, anybody could apply, and at anybody's, at whose discretion. That's kind of confusing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson. And I think probably this is best answered perhaps at your Wednesday hearing, when
fine.
You have some of the lenders will be here to testify, as well as Business Oregon.
Just a comment all along. I would draw your attention to the second paragraph, where it says the loans are guarantees. Who makes the loans are financial institutions using whatever criteria they choose to make, and essentially trying to decide whether they're going to get the money back or not, whether the borrower is that. It's harder. All this is a guarantee. It's very similar to the Small Business Administration's 7A program. It's been around since the early 1990s, and I think when it was originally enacted, because I remember when former Senator Cohen pushed this bill, I don't think there were any restrictions. So the legislature must have put restrictions on it after the fact. I don't remember when we did that. But, the issue is really one of small businesses. It is hard for a small business to get a loan. And it's really, Senator Girod, it really isn't taking anything away from the rural areas. I think they're still capable of getting that enhancement loan. It really gets to be to make it more likely that a banker is going to make the loan to a small business, regardless of where they are in the state. That's kind of the core of the issue. Other questions? Well, thank you, Senators.
Thank you.
We will take this up in public hearing again on Wednesday, I believe, Mrs. Patrick. But I would ask, is there anybody in the audience who wants to comment on this bill at this point? Seeing none, we will move on. We don't have to close the public hearing since we don't have one. So we're going to start up then, move to Senate Bill 1583. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1583 authorizes the Office of Small Business Assistance as part of its duties to coordinate with and provide assistance to county municipal agencies and authorities. It authorizes the office to refer small businesses to the appropriate resources, answer questions posed by the small business. There is an emergency clause, so it would take effect upon passage. And I believe our first panelists are right here, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Representative, would you like to go first?
I'm going to defer to the governor's office.
Oh, you are? All right.
Chair Vire, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick. I'm a senior policy advisor in the governor's office, and I'm here today on behalf of the governor to submit Senate Bill 1583 for your consideration. As the governor has said, in support of a thriving statewide economy, she is committed to strengthening government's ability to add value to Oregon's overall economic enterprise. Essential to this effort is supporting and growing Oregon's small businesses. They fuel our economic engine. Currently, an estimated 95% of our state businesses are small businesses, and they employ 55% of working Oregonians. In fact, Senate Bill 1583 builds on efforts the governor first undertook as Secretary of State in 2013. With the help of key legislators, including Representative Gomberg, she proposed and the legislature approved the creation of the Office of Small Business Assistance in the Secretary of State's office. Since the office opened in January of 2014, it has proven to be a great success, both in helping small businesses navigate government regulations and also in identifying problems to be addressed. Identifying systematic problems to be solved, and of course solving them, is critical work that I think we all believe in. It can be as simple yet as meaningful as a business owner feeling like someone is in their court and willing to make a phone call, make an introduction, or ask questions on their behalf. In many instances, the small business advocate can address the issues with a simple phone call or an explanation. In other cases, the advocate has been able to identify true issues that involve legislative solutions or administrative rule adjustments. The office is able to identify these issues for the legislature or the agency, and the outcome is good for everyone. And most importantly, it is good for Oregon's small businesses. Building on this track record, the governor seeks to expand the authority of this office to include local governments as well. She has learned that, generally, businesses view local and state regulators as one entity. In order for the government to best support small businesses, there should be one easy point of access, someone to call in any situation and receive guidance as to resources, information, and answers. An ombudsman, essentially, that provides a one-stop shop that facilitates problem solving and adds value to Oregon's overall economic enterprise as a public partner that government, both state and local, should and can be. Senate Bill 1583 expands the office in two simple yet essential ways. First, it grants the office authority to act as an advocate or ombudsman for small businesses, regardless of which area of government that the small business is interacting with. So both state agencies and local entities. Second, it mandates that the office serve as a resource to all businesses at any stage of development to maximize the many resources that the legislature, the agencies, and local governments already have in place. The Office of Small Business Assistance has already helped hundreds of small businesses navigate state government. Senate Bill 1583 will expand those resources to serve more and serve better Oregon's small businesses. State government can and should help businesses grow. Senate Bill 1583 is another step in that direction. Thank you for the opportunity to share my testimony today.
I guess I have a couple questions. Now, what we're talking about is an ombudsman role, correct? And incumbent in that role generally is the ability to be an advocate for and to provide assistance, but they have no formal authority to act or compel action. Is that accurate?
That is correct. It is. I think the office, the way Senator Beyer, members of the committee, the way the office is set to function is in that very type of role, to facilitate, to connect people, to make sure things flow a little easier. And if there really is a problem, which many times there isn't, it helps the business feel supported, and it allows the state to gather some information as to what businesses are dealing with and what they identify as issues in their eyes.
So this is just really kind of, in some ways, clear direction to the small business office and the staff that works there, just saying if any Oregon business from wherever calls and is having an issue with government, it's that person's job to try and help them resolve the conflict.
Senator Breyer, that is correct.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
This is only one employee? One person? Ombudsman?
I interpret it to be
like they're running now, and when I was a county commissioner, somebody would come out from the state on economic development, sit in your meeting, work with your issues, and now you're expanding it so there's more out there with the eyes and ears to the ground in the city meetings and stuff. That's how I interpret it. That's not the way it is.
Senator Thompson, members of the committee, I will defer to Robert Taylor, the Deputy Secretary of State, to answer that.
My name is Robert Taylor. I'm the Deputy Secretary of State. In the audience, we have our Corporation Director, Peter Threlkell, and the Small Business Ombudsman, Ruth Miles. She's here today. The Office of Small Business Assistance is housed in the Corporation Division. So Ruth Miles works for Peter. Ruth has herself and another staff person.
Oh.
So the Office of Small Business Assistance is two people,
okay,
one of whom is Ruth, the small business advocate. And we also have some additional resources or ability to add a third person. So what this bill does is expands our existing authority. So if Ruth gets a phone call and somebody's having difficulty at the county or local level, Ruth can go and have those conversations with the city or county. And Senator Beyer, you're absolutely right that what Ruth's job really is to facilitate communication. I think she has found in all of the cases she has worked in that communication is really the fundamental problem. And so Ruth works collaboratively as a facilitator. I often think of her as an interpreter between the small business and the government regulator, helping the small business person navigate some of those problems.
Follow up.
So right now, she can't help a city or county?
So right now she can. So if somebody says, I'm having trouble with this particular entity, Ruth is all about picking up the phone and being a direct point of contact. What this bill would do would be to grant her that formal authority to go ahead and do that and help kind of bring in line more with what she's doing. And we think it would be a useful tool both for Ruth to have and for the cities and counties to understand that Ruth has a role here to help facilitate.
So it's just formally recognizing what she's already doing.
In some cases, but also give her, kind of empower her to go have these conversations.
Senator, do you have more?
I won't say what I was going to say. I'm going to say I'm working on my attitude.
All right, we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that's a good plan.
Robert, do you have anything else to say?
The only thing I would add is later this session, Ruth is going to put out what she calls the State of Small Business. It's a report that she puts out annually. You'll see that the office opened in January 2014, and she's opened 399 cases in those first 2 years. And in this past year, she's handled 219 cases for businesses and nonprofits all over Oregon. And I believe the committee has some information that was supplied by some of those businesses, so you can get a flavor of the good work that Ruth does.
Representative.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much. I am David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast and the Coastal Range. I'm also a small business owner on the Oregon Coast. I was so pleased to be a champion of the bill that created the Office of Small Business Assistance, and I'm happy to be back with all of you today to add some clarity to their role. Yeah, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. Sometimes people smile when we say that, but here's an example of where it really works, and it really is making a difference for small businesses. And many of those small businesses, as you well understand, don't have HR departments, don't have attorneys or accountants on hand. And when they run into a problem with government, they're looking for a simple place to go and get answers. And this office is providing those answers, but there are some limitations. And the limitations are that they are empowered to act on interact with state agencies, but they're not empowered to interact with counties or municipalities, except with a wink. So we want to take the wink away because, you know, you call, I call this small business 911. This is where you call when you got a problem. And if you call up 911 and say, hi, I've got a problem, you don't want the operator on the other side to say, well, you know, I'm not really supposed to talk to you about that kind of emergency. I can only deal with those emergencies over there. So here we're going to add some clarity. We're going to empower this office to keep doing the good work they're doing and to do more of it. I think it's a good bill, and I encourage you to get it over to the House side, and we'll make it into law for you.
I bet you will. Any questions? I would just comment that I used to do a lot of this work professionally, and from my perspective, usually when the business person has an issue, they really have no idea who's responsible for it, whether it's state, federal, or whatever, and just more. I liked your term interpretation because that helps a lot, and then sometimes if there's a problem at whatever level, just having somebody else intervene with a little more facilitation skills and a little more impartially away from the issue, you can get things resolved fairly quickly. So I think it's a good program, small, but recognizing it's just a response, I think it's an appropriate thing to do. Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the audience?
Two more.
No, I do have. I'm sorry. There were some others.
Yeah.
I have Tim Cowan. And Wendy Johnson?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. Wendy Johnson? Welcome. Whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm summoned in a neighboring hearing as well, so I think if I could go first. Wendy Johnson, League of Oregon Cities, here to support the bill. As you heard from the previous panel, it's really a partnership between state and local government. We kind of looked at it as a kind of like a regional solutions model of how can we sit at the table together and figure these things out. The League has requested and worked with the governor's office on an amendment to deal with a little bit of the technical issues on the definition of municipality and agency. But then also, so it is clear that this isn't compelling any other government to do something. It's really about working together. So you should be receiving that amendment. But the essence of it is still the same of working together on how to, getting the person to the right place, which government agency or entity, and then also helping to facilitate conflicts. And so Ruth is doing a great job with that. We've heard from our members as well how that work is going, and so we support the bill and just the efforts to continue to bring business to rural and urban Oregon.
A little protective of your home rule?
a little bit there, yes. Thank you.
Okay. Questions, Winnie? Don't see any.
Thank you.
Chairman, committee members, a lot of my questions have been answered, and I'll postpone some until Wednesday. Here's a couple. Section 2, A and B. I would like to have you consider put federal in there. I didn't see the word
Excuse
federal.
Excuse me, could you identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry, sir. Tim Cowan, for the record. Take a look and see if you consider putting federal in there. Will they have the ability to discuss terms provided by state agencies? For example, it could be that after satisfaction of the service or providing the product, the state agency might take 90 days to pay it. I would like to have them consider or have that included in there. They might be able to go negotiate terms with that agency. The last one would be the role, if any, under Section 3, a resolution of a complaint if a private lending party is involved. Will they have the ability to do that? Sir, that's all I have.
Any questions, Mr. Cullen? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this? I don't see anybody else. Okay, so we're going to move down and take up insurance. First bill we're going to take up then is Senate Bill 1591.
And Patrick, should you want to open these two bills together?
Actually, we could do both of them, 1591 and 1590 at the same time. Patrick.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1591, I'll start with that one. It's shorter. It establishes a task force on insurance regulation. It has a subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And then Senate Bill 1590 is a longer one, so I will dispense with explaining that because Senator Shields is here. You do it much better than I can, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, and I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. Insurance is the only line of business that is exempt from Oregon's premier anti-fraud statute. Banking used to be exempt, but the legislature removed that exemption from the 2010 special session. Now, we've tried in the past to bring insurance under the state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. That bill passed the House in 2013, but died in the Senate. In the process of that discussion, it became clear to me that Oregon is a bit of an outlier in the West, in that it has very few mechanisms in statute to incent good faith and fair dealing by insurance companies when it comes to two issues. One, the first is fulfilling the insurer's duty to defend the policyholder when that policyholder is being sued. The duty to defend is a very important insurance benefit in insurance policies. And then number two, around the timely investigation and payment of meritorious claims. As former Still Reeves attorney Scott Kaplan wrote in the memo that's attached to my document, my testimony, and also I believe has been put up on OLIS, as that Still Reeves attorney has stated, quote, "You have asked why policyholders in Washington are much more likely to have their claims paid paid in full or closer to it, and paid more quickly with less need to resort to coverage litigation than policyholders in Oregon. The answer, in brief, is that Washington's statutory and regulatory scheme provides real incentives for insurance companies to pay meritorious claims and pay them promptly, while Oregon law provides no such incentives. And again, this is from Astill Reeves' attorney, the premier business law firm in the state. In Oregon, the incentive is for insurance companies to deny claims because even if the claim is wrongfully denied, the policyholder's only remedy is expensive breach of contract litigation to make the insurance company pay what it should have to have paid to begin with. The same kind of concepts apply to the duty to defend. If you breach the duty to defend your policyholder, there's really no downside to doing it because the policyholder has to sue you, and if you end up losing, all you have to do is to provide the defense that you should provided in the first place. Additionally, the legislature in 2013 all but unanimously gave a private right of action and other tort-like remedies for mostly larger businesses in environmental insurance policies. That law, Senate Bill 814, amended the Oregon Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act, or OECA, and it set forth treble damages for breaching the duty to defend, treble damages for failure to make timely investigation, for delay in timely participation in mediation, and treble damages for breach of payment of meritorious claims. In other words, Senate Bill 814 incentivized good faith and discouraged bad faith, but only for big businesses. As business attorney Kevin Mapes of Ball Janik, another business firm, wrote, quote, the statutory good faith settlement process put in place by the OECA amendments is now being put into practice, allowing settlements to go forward. The system, in other words, works, at least in the context of environmental claims. But from a policy perspective, he writes, it seems odd at best to treat policyholders and insurers differently depending on the nature of the underlying litigation. The Oregon legislature should at least consider should at least consider making those two things similar regardless of the nature of the policy and the size of the business. So the we looked at tort-like remedies like treble damages for breaching the duty to defend, but we decided on a more measured approach that kept the remedy within the confines of the policy limits. So we went with codifying that if you breach the duty to defend, you simply forfeit your coverage defenses. In other words, if the court finds that you breached your duty to defend, the consequences is that you just have to pay the claim, and that way the small business defendant doesn't have to. This is also known as coverage by estoppel. This language is based on model language from the American Law Institute. And then there are several smaller things that are taking place in the bill, that like transparency in the insurance division's complaint process, having the insurance division retain and enforce policy language that's been presented to it, an independent counsel provision, and then a farm equipment fix that would close a gap in statutes regarding tractors and whether or not they fall under auto or farm policies. I'd also like to call to your attention, Mr. Chair, some amendments that have been drafted, and we've got the dash one back, which I believe is up on OLIS at this point, which we received from the insurance division to improve the transparency piece, and if that's not up on OLIS, we'll be sure to get it to you. We have another amendment that's being drafted right now that will clarify that this does not apply to workers' comp. That's its own regulatory scheme, and this bill would not apply to it. So in closing, Mr. Chair, before I hand it off to my good colleague who is also part of that work group, there are some people in groups who oppose this bill because it doesn't go far enough. And there are some people in groups who oppose this bill because it goes too far. That says to me, Mr. Chair, that we struck a pretty good compromise. A year's worth of work has gone into this bill. I hope the committee will adopt the Dash 1 Amendment and the forthcoming Workers' Compensation Exclusion Amendment, ask the President's Office to rescind the Ways and Means referral, and send the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation. So that's regarding Senate Bill 1590. Senate Bill 1591 is really just a placeholder bill that we put to accompany it to have a broader relating to clause in case we needed that there. There have been some amendments drafted for that related to the transparency piece for transparency in the claims complaint process, as well as the what they call regulatory estoppel, which is the kind of the insurance division holding on to the policies and making sure that the claims process down the road relates well to the policy as originally submitted to the Insurance Division.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be very brief because I'm supposed to be in two places at the same time, and they're waiting for me to kick off a bill over there. I appreciate the opportunity that, oh, for the record, Chris Edwards, State Senator from Eugene. I appreciate the opportunity that Senator Shields gave to me to sit on this work group because it was eye-opening for myself. I mean, if you were like me, you've never been through this type of a process as a potential defendant. So if you haven't been through this type of a process, you might not understand, you know, that you can really end up stuck between a rock and a hard place in a position where somebody is making a claim against you and your insurance company may or may not be choosing to defend you in that process. And the only way to get them to defend you is to bring a lawsuit against them. And so now you're fighting a two-front, a war or a battle on two different fronts, and can certainly put you in a bind. So the process that we went through in sitting down, not with you know, traditionally in the legislature, this has been a showdown between insurance companies and trial attorneys, and that brings feelings across the board from different people in the legislature about who's better or who's worse. But this was really interesting, this process, because we sat down with small business attorneys that are representing their clients and may be being paid by an insurance company, or may not be being paid by an insurance company. And so I think this is a good piece of legislation. I'm not going to go through all the details. I think Senator Shields has done that. But I think this is a very reasonable approach, and hopefully we can get it done this session.
Questions? Senator Thompson?
Yeah. Senator Shields, what always makes me nervous when I see tractor in a bill? What are you doing with that? Is it, do you like farmers or do you not like farmers?
I'm pro farmer, for the record.
Perfect. But what does that do? Like, because I own tractors, I know I insure them. I don't insure them like a vehicle. Farm insurance covers them. Does right. this change that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, one of the small business lawyers brought forward a problem that he saw in the law. And so as we were making our laundry list, this was kind of a small fix where there was a farmer who was driving their tractor on a two-lane highway between their two tracts of land, got creamed from behind by an auto vehicle, and the farm policy wouldn't cover it because it wasn't on the farm, and the auto policy wouldn't cover it because it wasn't in an auto. And in most states, that is covered in the statute, and the way the statute's written, there's some ambiguity around Oregon statute, evidently, and the insurance company was denying coverage, and we wanted to clarify that.
Okay. Sounds like pro-farmer to me.
Yeah. Makes me nervous. Thank you.
More?
Thank you.
No? Senator?
Yeah, I have a couple questions here. This seems like a fairly significant change to insurance law. Why the short session to do this?
Because I'm not going to be here in 2017.
Okay. The second thing is, did you model this after any other state law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, the duty to defend part is modeled after model language from the American Law Institute, number one. And it's also similar to what happens in Washington, where that coverage by estoppel concept happens. Evidently, Washington has two remedies. One is treble damages, which we thought was a bridge too far and could actually go outside the policy and could be big, big money. The approach that we're doing is the second approach in Washington, which is that if you roll the dice, deny the duty, your duty to defend, and you're wrong, you just got to pay the claim.
Okay, the final question. Those states that have implemented similar laws, what have been the negative effects? Because I know the cost of insurance will go up. So other than the cost of insurance, what negative effects have?
I'm not sure that there are any. There will be some more legally versed experts coming to your office tomorrow. I'd be happy to run that question by them, make sure that they're well prepared for it.
Senator, wasn't during the work, I'm trying to remember, during the work group, didn't we have some commentary or correspondence with the Washington Office of Insurance that said their rates had not gone up?
That's true, and I think we've uploaded that document to OLIS.
Yes, there's
no. Others? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Have a list of people who wanted to come and testify. Let's see. It looks like we have a panel of David Rossmiller, Everett Jack, and Steve Patterson. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Whenever you're ready.
Chairman Beyer, Vice Chair Girard, and members of the committee, thank you for having us here. I'm David Rossmiller. I'm a partner at the Betts Patterson & Mines law firm in Portland. My field is insurance coverage, which deals with insurance disputes, and I'm here on behalf of the American Insurance Association and the Property Casualty Insurers Association to oppose Senate Bill 1590. I don't agree from my reading of this bill that it's just a slight change or that it's just turning a few dials up a few degrees. This is a very, very big change in Oregon law. And in fact, if the main sections of the bill appear to be modeled after certain remedies or clauses in other states, but they're even beyond those provisions in other states. So talking just about what Senator Shields had mentioned about the duty to defend, now I know this language gets really technical, and I'm not sure if anybody on the committee is an insurance lawyer, so I don't want to just throw jargon at you. But the duty to defend is that somebody gets sued and then an insurance company either is going to defend them or not based on whether those allegations would fall within the language of the policy. There are already remedies for failure to do that in Oregon. And I've practiced in this field for quite a long time, and I've represented both policyholders and insurance companies. And I don't think that there's a rash of people unjustly being denied defenses. I'm sure it has happened, but I don't think that's a huge problem, and I didn't see any findings of fact connected with the bill that would say so. Talking about the remedies for that, so that word breach of the duty to defend would be used where an insurer does a range of things that would amount to not defending or does something else regarding the defense that would be a breach. One of the troubling things about this bill from my perspective is that there isn't a standard for breach. In Washington, for example, which is even beyond what you would see in other states, Washington would be at the far end of the spectrum of remedies. But this is beyond that, because at least Washington has a standard for when you violated the duty to defend. That is, you have to commit bad faith. And that means there has to be some damages, and they have to be unremedied. That is, in Washington, if you are alleged to have breached the duty to defend as an insurance company, you have to get a notice. And that notice is given to the insurance commissioner, and you get a chance to cure whatever they say is the problem, what you've done wrong. There aren't any provisions like that in this law. So it's really kind of, and also, as I mentioned, in Washington, you and other states, you have to have some damage. That is, if you fix it, that it really isn't a breach. That isn't true under this bill. If you do anything, it's a form of strict liability, and so there's it's not encouraging companies to note problems and fix them. Instead, it's making a standard where it's strict liability. Even an honest mistake would result in you being, as an insurance company, prohibited from being involved in the defense at all, and more or less forced to pay whatever settlement is agreed upon between the claimant and the insured. That's giving a lot of control, a lot of power to people to settle out cases and make someone else to pay for it. And maybe there's a lot of people who can use that power without being tempted to abuse it. But I suspect there may be some that are tempted to abuse that. I don't want to take up all the time here because we have I'll be back on Wednesday, and my friend Everett Jack here is going to be here only today. So I'm only going to cover one more thing, and then Mr. Jack, I know, has got some things to say that I won't need to go over. But the regulatory estoppel aspect of this bill, I mean, that's different than this kind of estoppel I just spoke about. This is estoppel in the context that I just spoke about means a court will prohibit you from using the clauses in your insurance policy as a defense to paying. Regulatory estoppel is a different concept. That regulatory estoppel is using what somebody said, supposedly an insurance company, to regulators to get clauses in insurance policies approved so they can sell them in the state. Now that is something, this particular feature of the bill is something that no other state has. This is very far out there. No state is, that I'm aware of, has enacted this by statute. There are a few states where such a concept is recognized, but only in a very, very limited context of environmental contamination insurance and exclusions that would pertain to that. So that's a very small subset of policies, of kinds of policies, of insurance disputes, and just a few states, just a very few. In every other state where it's been brought up, the courts have rejected it because it goes against what the courts do. The courts are able to, in every state, they will read the insurance policy and then read the lawsuit to see if there's any ambiguity in the policy. Going into regulatory records about whether somebody said something or whether regulators relied on it, this can be not only very confusing to make a court do this, and it makes them give up their interpretive methodology that they already use, but that's a very big discovery problem. Some of these things, these representations or statements, could have been made 5, 10, 20, or even 30 years in the past. And I think that judges would really balk at something like this, saying, how are we supposed to sort all this out? And how are we supposed to, why are we having to second guess what regulators did and decide what regulators actually decided upon, what was the basis of their decision? I think that's something that's very, a very, very huge change. Both those provisions that I talked about, in addition to some other things that I won't go into today, put this not as a as a compromise between two extremes, but actually on the extreme. Thank you.
Who's next?
I think I am. Senator Beyer and members of the committee. If I don't get this all right, please, I apologize. This is a foreign country to me, so.
don't worry about it.
but my name is Everett Jack, and I am a lawyer from Portland, and I work with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. I saw this bill about a week ago, and when I read it, I immediately asked my clients if I could come down and talk about it. But no one's paying me to be here. I'm here on my own. I actually was in Los Angeles, and I flew up just to be here today. I can't be here on Wednesday. I'm going to be on the East Coast, but I thought it was important that what I have to say is able to be heard. I feel like I have, I'm in a unique position, given my work history and what I do now, that I can shed some light on some of these issues, and I think I'm a pretty fair and reasonable person, so I can say what I've seen in the course of my practice based on these kinds of things being passed into law or becoming common law by virtue of decisions from judges. I grew up in Portland. My parents live here. I, you know, lived in St. John's. I mean, this is my community, so this was kind of important to me. So I'm the first thing that I should say is that your insurance does not cover everything that bad that ever happens to you. It just is not written that way. There are bad things that will happen to people all the time that are not covered by insurance. And there is a duty to defend in insurance policies, and there is a duty to indemnify. And the duty to defend is structured based upon what your duty to indemnify says. So as broad as your duty to indemnify is as broad as your duty to defend is. It sets the parameters for when the insurance company is obligated to defend you. So the nature of the policy that you get and the scope of the coverage and the exclusions to the coverage, those define the obligation of the insurance company to defend you. And at my firm, I have the luxury of working for lots of different insurance companies all over the country, which is great. And I also work for lots of our business clients who have insurance, who need to get insurance. So I talk to them about a lawsuit where they get filed and whether or not there's insurance coverage for it. And we talk through ways to address that. In this instance, what this bill did for me is it threw up a lot of what I'm going to tell you I have seen in other jurisdictions, really bad practical effects for consumers. It's not going to help small business owners in the David Douglas area or in Linn County because what happens when you start imposing punitive aspects on insurance companies for their policies is that they decide that they will not take on the risk. Now, I hate to say this because Oregon's a great state and I grew up here, but the economic base that we have in the state of Oregon is not the state of Washington. They can get away with things because of the economic drivers in that city, in that state, that we do not have in Oregon. We do not have a big Boeing. We do not have a Microsoft. We do not have an Amazon. We do not have many of the very large businesses that they have there that make insurance companies feel willing to take on the risk to write insurance in those states. Relative to our business climate, we're a little bigger than Montana, but we're very similar to states like Montana in that regard. And I want to give an example about a matter I had that involved Montana. My client's insured was an Oregon company, and we had a dispute over whether or not there was coverage for it. We were defending them, and there was an underlying case in Montana. There were 42 parties in that case, and I went to a mediation in Missoula, Montana. And I looked around the room. We were in a big conference room. I looked around the room, and all of the defendants in the case all had insurance company representatives representing them, every one of them. What was strange to me is that, and this is the first time it hit me, and this was 2 years ago, every single one of the Montana companies, the small companies from Montana, all had something called a surplus lines carrier insuring them. And the out-of-state defendants had admitted carriers. Now, I know from what I just heard Mr. Rossmiller say, you guys may not hear a lot of those terms thrown around, so I'll take the time to describe the difference. An admitted carrier is an insurance carrier that submits their forms to the state and the insurance commissioner blesses the language of the form. And a lot of times, there's something called an ISO form. That's a form where maybe the carriers will work together on an agreed form. They'll submit it to the state along with comments. But they work together, try and make the workload easier for everybody. Those kinds of carriers have language in their policies that are approved by the state, and those carriers are also insured by the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. Surplus lines carriers are insurance carriers that can only write business in the state if admitted carriers refuse to write the business. I think it's two. If two admitted carriers refuse to write the business, they can go to a surplus lines carrier. Now, why does that matter? Well, surplus lines carriers aren't limited to only issuing policies on admitted paper. In other words, they can write a policy that isn't on the same form that the admitted carriers have. So they don't have to submit their form to the insurance commissioner. They can write their policy and write out all kinds of additional exclusions to coverage that the admitted carriers won't have. The other thing is those surplus lines carriers, they are not backed by the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. So if that carrier, that surplus lines carrier, goes bankrupt, the Insurance Guarantee Association for Oregon is not going to step in and pay it like it does for an admitted carrier. Now, so let's go back to my example in Montana. We had 42 parties, and all of the local Montana companies all had surplus lines carriers. In my experience with the surplus lines carriers that I work with, that means those insureds paid more money for their insurance, and they got less broad coverage. They got worse coverage than everybody else. And everybody in the state of Montana got that. Now, why does Montana have that? Well, because Montana has a concept called coverage by estoppel, exactly what this bill does. The minute it says if you deny the duty to defend and you lose insurance company, you're going to pay. Doesn't matter, you're going to pay. And that's one of the symptoms of that. The second thing that happens in those jurisdictions is there's a lot more insurance coverage litigation. Notwithstanding the fact that Mr. Kaplan, who I don't think was referenced, I don't think he's at Stoll Reeves anymore. He's at another law firm. But it does not result in less litigation. It results in more litigation, and I will explain that too. In Washington, for instance, and I work there, there must be three times more coverage litigation. At least, maybe more. And in Montana, there's more than that. And the reason is because if I'm an insured and I have the ability to get my claim paid and maybe catch a windfall, and I have no downside in that litigation, and I have no downside because I don't have to pay the insurance company's fees if I lose, so I take the risk and I go for that. Maybe it's treble damages, maybe it's something else. But there is an effort to seek a windfall. It will not result in less litigation. It will result in fewer carriers wanting to write business in the state, unfortunately. And another brief example of this exact concept, the same case in Montana, the plaintiff who brought the lawsuit and the defendant, one of the defendants, the main defendant in the case, were sister companies owned by the same individual. And in the course of the litigation, they were at first both plaintiffs on one side of the litigation. And to try and trigger insurance coverage, they actually switched one of the parties from a plaintiff to a defendant so that the defendant now could get insurance coverage. It could trigger insurance coverage. So we had two plaintiffs, and we went from two plaintiffs to one plaintiff and one defendant. My client picked up the defense on the defendant. In the course of the case, the defendant then had one of their carriers who said, we're not going to defend you. And so they ran out and they stipulated to a judgment in this Montana lawsuit for $16 million. Okay? In my case in Oregon, we went in front of Judge Mossman here, and he concluded that the judgment that was stipulated to for $16 million was a result of fraud and collusion. Which seems like a reasonable conclusion to reach, given that they were sister companies and one was both plaintiffs and now one's a defendant. However, in Montana, where that underlying case was going forward and that stipulated judgment was entered into, the Montana court had to enter that judgment for $16 million, notwithstanding the fact that there's a federal judge in Oregon who says it's the result of fraud and collusion. Look, I will admit I work on the carrier side way more than I work on the policyholder side. My concern here was when I looked at the bill, it is not going to be good for small businesses. In the long term, you're going to get less good coverage from surplus lines and carriers who will charge more for the premium. You know, I don't know where I hear statistics that were cited that Scott Kaplan says that there are claims paid faster in Washington. I have no idea where that data comes from. I've never heard that before. If it exists, I've never seen where it comes from. I don't know how you would ever know that either. But that's not my experience. I know Mr. Mapes. I know the players that are in this space, and I see it all around the country. This is not the kind of thing that's going to make the insurance system work better. It's the kind of thing that's going to make carriers not want to write business here. And I wish we were a bigger economic engine here that would really force them to have to want to be here, but they don't. And they won't take the risk if they think they're going to get beat down. I would encourage you to ask me any questions now because I'm going to unfortunately not be able to be around on Wednesday.
Why don't we hear from this gentleman, and then we'll get to questions. Okay?
Thank you, Chairman Beyer, Senator Girard, members. My name is Steve Patterson. I'm Vice President, General Counsel with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. And unlike the big carriers that can make a decision, we've been in Oregon for 122 years, starting this year. So I would start with the premise that you wouldn't make it 122 weeks, let alone 122 years, if your practice was cheating your policyholders. The consumers are very aware. I know the Oregon Department of Insurance advertises to make sure that they're aware of the remedies that are available to them, as well as the ones that were discussed here that are available at law. I might also add, since it came up, I'm currently the chairman of the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association, so I both accept and appreciate that Mr. Jack brought up the difference between the admitted and not admitted carriers. I wanted to touch on a couple things here that are just kind of practical impacts of what I heard. One, the bills that came before this that were mentioned were all trying to build Oregon small businesses. These small businesses are really the bread and butter of a company like Oregon Mutual. That's who we want to insure, Main Street businesses in your communities and in our own. This bill doesn't help them, and certainly it doesn't help us. And I think by all the lawyers that are testifying, it may help the business of lawyers. No disrespect, gentlemen. A couple things were mentioned by the proponent, Senator Shields, that I was glad to hear because I wasn't sure by reading the bill what was intended. First, I know that they said that there was some committee that got together over the last year. Now, there may have been lawyers in that room, and there may have been some elected officials, but I don't recall ever being invited that there weren't any insurers in the room. So I'm unaware of the idea that this is a big compromise, and as I read it, I'm concerned about the bill. One of the things that was answered is this isn't limited to just business insurance. It says casualty insurance, which could be personal auto insurance or any number of personal insurance, or commercial liability insurance. I use that or to say, now we know what that one means, because there's another or in here that I think is important. It says the insured defends a claim. This is for when you get additional counsel that the company, as us, would have to hire our insured, a lawyer, to defend only their interest and not do what our lawyers are required to do now, which is consider the interest of the insured as high or higher than our own insured. They have to balance what the contract says and their obligations there with the best defense for the insured. So it says you get this lawyer when the insured defends a claim under reservation of rights, or if the insured has potential liability with respect to claims that exceed the limits of the policy. So we don't even have to defend, we don't even have to get you a lawyer if somehow we've defended under reservation of rights, which simply means we're going to provide you a lawyer, even though we're not sure the facts or the policy yet cover the situation under which you have presented a claim. But now, if the claim makes our insured subject to potential additional liability over their policy limits, then we also have to get them an insurer or a lawyer. And this is problematic, because what happens then is that lawyer whose only interest is getting the insured out of any potential liability above their policy will start acting against the interest of the insurance company and, I would say, the general public who buys insurance by stipulating the judgments as was meant or engaging in negotiations that are designed to settle out the claim without anybody involved in that settlement having any financial stake in the outcome except for the plaintiff. I guess I would also say in that when you businesses in Oregon are faced with a choice, where are you going to get your insurance and how much you're going to pay for it? What are the coverages? What are the coverages that are important to the risk that you bear as a business owner? They make financial choices about these every day. I think it's important when it was said. Insurance doesn't cover everything. So you can get additional liability or potential additional liability by simply insuring for too little. One of the things that's good about the current law is you insure to what you believe the risk you present bears, the insurance that you can afford at the limits that are available, and then you're supposed to, as an individual or business, mitigate the risk of loss you pose to other people by taking stock of your activity, getting loss prevention, making sure drivers with your company are well licensed and have good records, all these kind of things. Chair Senator Thompson, I had to mention the tractors, too. I don't know what that's for.
Yeah.
Uninsured motorist coverage. The language of the bill dealing with tractors and changing the current code to move a tractor from being considered not to be an uninsured vehicle, except while it's on a public road, to take that out and say that it is an uninsured vehicle unless the tractor equipment is on a public road. So I don't know if they're trying to cover the tractor while it's on the farm or in between. So that's confusing. I think that's going to need some work. A couple other things real quick. The regulatory estoppel is concerning. I work with the Department of Insurance quite a bit. I respect the people that work there, and I've done that work on rates and forms for over 20 years now. The idea that we're going to turn the people at the Department of Insurance into court reporters, who are, and oftentimes we'll file a rate and we'll talk about a certain provision in the policy, and that's not the one that ends up being approved. So the idea that anybody other than the declarant, the insurance company, who makes a statement about what they intend when they're submitting a proposal for coverage is troubling to me. It puts a lot of pressure and a lot of control in the hands of people who may not have understood or heard the discussion in the same manner in which we had it. And practically that's happened, whether it's been regulatory interaction on financial examinations or not. We've described coverages we have that are reinsurance coverages that we buy from other carriers. And when the preliminary report came back to us, I could tell you I didn't recognize it. They just didn't understand what we were doing. So there are a lot of expertise there, but I think that's asking them to do too much, and it would be unfair to the carriers. Finally, I would mention on the idea of transparency. Under current law, the Department of Insurance not only is required to, but they do file a yearly report of insurance complaints against companies in the industry. And it's available online, and they do it every year, and it talks not only about the company and how much premium they write, but also the number of complaints that were filed, what they consider to be confirmed complaints, which is a definition I think the insurance industry would bristle at,
And then they also rank the companies and give them a sort of a score. Now, I can say in 2014, Oregon Mutual and Auto Insurance had one complaint and zero confirmed. But a confirmed complaint could be something as easy as the insured and the insurance company still don't agree on what the value of the claim was or the facts of the claim. So if we're going to increase any transparency in this area, we should really be looking to do something where if they need more information, it's about confirmed complaints that are somehow adjudicated. We have some right to contest, and there's a determination that some insurance law has been violated before we start creating discovery for lawyers or consumers or whoever to come back to you next session or the session after and say, boy, look at all the complaints we generated or that were generated. Here's the rationale we need to start another discussion on bad faith. So with that, I'll defer to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? Senator Gerard?
Yeah, actually, I have more than it's more like two comments. One, if I had to take back what you gentlemen said, and I want to thank you for your testimony because it brought home a couple points. One is if we increase the liability to insurance company, the insurance company is going to have two options. One, increase cost or not deliver the insurance. Those are the two options. The second thing is the complexity of what we're dealing here. And the fact that we're trying to do this in a short session is really disheartening to me because I know that one word can make a heck of a lot of difference. Mr. Jack, your testimony was excellent, and I'm sorry that you're not going to be here on Wednesday because I think all of you have a tremendous amount of knowledge that we want to tap into. So I just want to thank you for coming. And if you want to pile on either one of those comments, please do.
Others? Thank you, gentlemen. Most appreciate it. And we will take this up again on Wednesday. I'm sorry you can't be here.
No. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you coming down today. I'm actually flying back from L.A.
No, thank you so much.
All righty. I have two more people, Lloyd Bernstein and
Rick Blackwell and Eric Cutter.
Yeah. I'll get Bernstein first.
Yeah, sure.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, gentlemen, Senator Beyer and the committee. My name is Lloyd Bernstein. I'm an attorney with Bolvenhauser Bailey in Portland. Full disclosure, I am an insurance. My practice focuses in insurance coverage and insurance litigation. But I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. That is a group of almost 700 lawyers in the state of Oregon whose primary focus is in civil litigation defense. I am a member of the board of directors of OADC and also on their governmental affairs committee. To Senator Gerard's point of taking this up in a short session, and what concerned me was Senator Shields' comments about pushing it through simply because he's no longer going to be here next time around to champion this bill. The concerns that OADC has and our members have are essentially threefold, and it's not to some of the substantive issues, and I thought the gentleman before me did an excellent job, but it's the unintended consequences or collateral issues this may have on the defense bar and lawyers. Senator Shields referenced that this is similar to what happens, or it's modeled in some way after what happens in Washington. I practice up in Washington, and I can tell you on this failure to defend, duty to defend, this collateral litigation that ensues, there is a significant impact on the defense bar. The first issue that we have here in Oregon is a tripartite relationship. In simple terms, there is an equal relationship between the insurer, the insured, and defense counsel. And so the defense lawyer has an obligation to both the insurer and to the insured. If in doubt, it goes to the insured. Washington doesn't have that tripartite relationship. So when you overlay that bill onto the current ethical standards that are required of defense lawyers, there's going to be tension that needs to be reconciled. I don't have the answers for you as I sit here today. The OADC will be looking into this further. We'll have more of our committee members and providing more materials as we head towards Wednesday. But I wanted to make this committee aware that tripartite relationship here in Oregon would be impacted by this bill simply by putting this new legislation on top of what defense counsel is obligated to do under Oregon law. That needs to be reconciled. The second issue, which we see in Washington now, is insurance defense counsel, the lawyers retained by the insurer. So you've heard some great testimony as to the problems that happen in Washington. Let's say the idea of or the potential exposure of excess exposure doesn't happen until you're somewhere along the way down the lawsuit. So the insurance company retains defense counsel. They are defending the insurer through the suit. This issue of excess exposure comes up either through discovery, amendment of the pleadings, and then the insurer under this bill is obligated to retain for the insured his own a separate lawyer that's only obligated to the insured. What we see in Washington is that becomes another strain of litigation. That insurance defense lawyer becomes, for lack of a better term, not the object of, but a piece of the bad faith puzzle. Did the insurer hire that defense lawyer correctly? Did that defense lawyer do things correctly? What was done in defense of the case? And we've seen instances where that defense lawyer becomes, if not a key witness, in some instances, you have this leverage that occurs where the plaintiff's lawyer, the injured party, wants to get a settlement. The insured assigns all of its rights against the insurance company, saying they did all this, the bad stuff, bad faith. They assign it to the injured party's lawyer. In those negotiations, the injured party lawyer now, in some instances, is asking for an assignment of the malpractice claim against the defense lawyer. They see that as yet another vein to go down the bad faith road. And so I want to bring that to the attention of this panel and those folks, that this is yet another issue that needs to be dealt with. It's not that simple that, you know, we just need to change the law, and they've been trying. This proposal, this legislation, is a lot different animal than the UTPA Act that has been coming through the last several years prior to this session. The last piece of it is the attorney-client relationship. Again, when that relationship's established, when the insurance company retains defense counsel, an attorney-client relationship is established. And then when another lawyer comes in, that, whether it's the plaintiff's lawyer that gets the assignment from the insured or if a separate lawyer is then retained to only represent the insured, that attorney-client relationship that preexisted becomes in jeopardy. They want everything in all those communications. And I'll tell you, in Washington and other states, that attorney-client relationship has been eroding because of this duty to defend and bad faith litigation. It's just another piece of the puzzle that needs to be considered, the impact of this legislation that it will have on the civil practice of law and on the defense bar are concerns that the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel has. And because of those concerns, we have to object to this bill. Thank you. I'll take any
questions. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the UTPA. Would that have been a better solution?
The UTPA legislation, the problem with that legislation is it also left open the possibility of lawsuits against attorneys. So it's, from what I recall of the UTPA legislation, it didn't deal directly with the duty to defend. This is a whole different animal, so they're not even going after the same issues. That would create a statutory right to pursue insurers for things that they did wrong. Mm-hmm. This is strictly to the duty to defend. So I don't think you can compare them apples to apples.
Thank you. I got it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Others? I don't see any. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. The last one I have signed up is DCBS, Rick Blackwell and Eric Cutler.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and committee members. I'll be super brief for the committee's time today. I am Rick Blackwell. I'm the Manager of Policy and Actuarial Services for the Division of Financial Regulation, the part of DCBS that also once housed the Insurance Division. With me is Eric Cutler, who is the Manager of Product Regulation. And so we're just here to speak briefly on Senate Bill 1590. Given that it's not a bill that originated from us, we can't support or oppose it. We've certainly been consistently neutral on the concepts relating to UTPA or right to defend, though I do want to express my appreciation to Senator Shields' office for reaching out for input on the bill. I'd only cover two points. One, was the unclear impact on the workers' compensation system, which appears to perhaps be addressed by subsequent amendment. We just want to make sure that the separate regulatory system established by the Mahonia-Hall agreements in 1990 that created the exclusive remedy remain preserved, and this bill is unclear as to whether that result occurred or not. The second is the privacy and confidentiality issues. There's a difference in the expectation that a consumer may have when they file a complaint with us, direct with us, than a complaint they may have with their insurance carrier. The level of privacy, knowing that your complaint may result in a public action, I think is lessened than when if you're just trying to work something out with your insurance carrier. In any case, though, there are certain laws, such as the ID Theft Act, which was amended in the 15 session to include certain medical data, and HIPAA, which will always preempt the federal law or the state law. So we just want to be mindful how privacy was treated under the bill. I understand there will be an amendment. We haven't seen it yet, but we'll be happy to discuss it most likely Wednesday's hearing. A couple other things about privacy. We just want to make sure that our accreditation status with the NAIC is not jeopardized. If we're unaccredited by the NAIC, insurers that operate here are probably not going to be able to file insurance policies in other states. So we want to make sure that their ability to work in business across state lines is preserved.
Can you do a little more about what are the concerns there and who is that?
Am I going fast? Yeah. So the NAIC is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So this is the group of insurance commissioners across the 50 states. Part of being accredited is also ensuring that if a domestic insurer wants to work in Idaho, they can file with the Idaho Insurance Commissioner. No problem. If we lose our accreditation with that body, their ability to work in Idaho then is also in jeopardy.
What would be the concerns from this bill about accreditation?
Accreditation depends a lot on the state laws being fairly uniform in effect. If our laws on privacy of complaints is not uniform with the other states, the other accredited entities, then we could have an issue with our accreditation.
So is that mainly the privacy issue?
Yeah, privacy, okay. Privacy and complaints. Yeah. One way to try to make sure that we don't have an accreditation problem is just to ensure that complaints that are coming to us are appropriately redacted, and those are what's shared. Complaints that we discover in certain other enforcement or examination activities should stay exempt. So I think with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over for any questions.
Questions? Now, I know the commissioner was working on, I had to ask for her, is there an administrative approach that might be better than a legal approach? And do you have anything on that, or?
Well, we did submit a letter to both Senator Shields and yourself on a general framework, a general regulatory framework. We still remain open to enhancing our consumer protection mission. We can certainly review that in the interim with a spectrum of affected parties.
Senator?
Being someone who sits on Ways and Means, if this wasn't enacted, wouldn't DCBS have to hire some full-time overseers to make sure that they were in compliance?
Senator Beyer and Senator Gerard, this is in regards to the bill as drafted here or
yes.
The regulatory? Well, I don't know. I'll have to go back and see what the fiscal impact was. I think we've completed the fiscal. I think it's fairly absorbable.
Agreed that. No impact.
How? How can you have no impact on that? If you're going to oversee a whole new program, how can you have no impact? This sounds like a bait to get us to do it, and then you come back and ask for more money.
Senator Beyer and Senator Drott, I apologize. I'm referring to Senate Bill 1590 as drafted. The regulatory
question,
the alternatives
yes.
that were asked from us by Senator Beyer and Shields would certainly have an FTE, of course.
Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment at this point? Seeing none, we've hit the end of the agenda for the day.
Of course, good, Mr.
So is there anything else to before we adjourn? We're done.
Why are we here in this?
We're done.
Why are we here in this?